This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate Gee. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Jen Hawk and Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Hawk, how are you doing this evening?
I'm very well. Dr. Lyle is with us in spirit, I understand.
Yeah, well, we missed you last show, and so we figured that we would do one solo show with you this week. And again, apologies to the listeners. I deleted the two shows ago. I accidentally deleted the audio data and then left for the NHA conference the next day. So I did not have time to bring my recording gear and redo it. So it was a bit of almost a 10-day break between episodes, but the show is not going anywhere. And I know a couple of people were worried that we had been canceled or that, you know, Beat Your Genes had dropped off the face of the map, and apologies for that. But we are back and with another show with Dr. Hawk.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a few emails as well. People like, what's going on? Where's the show? And I've also the podcast/ I don't even know quite what to call it. It's not really a podcast. It's a random show on YouTube where I sometimes talk to Dr. Lyle, sometimes not, about current events and politics, called Hawk Blocked. And that's kind of, it's not been on hiatus either, but those episodes have been private for my Patreon supporters only. So people think it vanished from the face of the earth. So it's like, oh my God, you guys really have been canceled. You must have really stepped in it.
Yeah. And I realized that we just did the current events episodes, and then where I joke that, oh, if we get canceled, something, something. And then like we go dark for 10 days. So,
yeah, no, we'll let you guys know if we ever do get canceled. we'd post about it somewhere. I have a page on Gab now, which is where all of the real baddies hang out. So they can't censor us.
Oh, you do.
There.
What's the what's this page called?
It's called the Evo Psych Ward. So you can, I have just a personal profile, but I have multiple groups over there, and one of them is the Evo Psych Ward. So people can join. There's not much conversation going on there yet, but certainly people are welcome to wander over. And the glory of Gab is that it's got kind of 4chan, 8chan style free speech rules, where as long as you're not violating the laws of the United States, you can say pretty much anything you want. So that's how it works. It's a free speech bonanza. Melly is taking advantage of my concentration to eat Mo's food right now. That's what's going on in the background.
But are they on Gab too, Melly and Mo?
They should be. They should be. They have things to tell the world.
Well, we might hear it tonight. But yeah, come join Dr. Hawk on Gab. That should be fun. I always enjoy reading these things, these types of forums. So, well,
you can just find me. You could search for my name over there. I'm gonna hold on. Let me get this away from her. Melly. She's a bad, bad, bad dog. Okay. All right. Do we want to back up like a second and just kind of...
No. So tell me more. But so speaking of the NHA conference, Dr. Hawk. You did a talk there. I did a talk there. What'd you think?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, I missed your talk, although it was great to see you after being separated by the forces of COVID for so long. So your talk was right before I got in. But this was, it was my first NHA, National Health Association. And so it was my first one, and it was great to go. It's kind of a, Doug and I are both kind of half, one foot in this plant-based health world and one foot sort of in a more general evolutionary psychology or just psychology world. And so it was interesting. It was very sort of devoted to cutting edge research and exactly what to eat and what not to eat and lifestyle issues for staying ahead of chronic disease and all the rest. And a very intense approach to all of those things. So the thesis of my talk was more nuanced than I think sometimes it can be interpreted as, which is I was really just trying to talk about personality, which we talk about here on the show all the time, and the limits of personality when it comes to perfection in anything, and particularly perfection on a healthy diet of any kind, whatever sort of diet and lifestyle you are personally pursuing. But I have just talked to so many people. I have watched again and again and again that people striving for this sort of total compliant perfection on a whole food plant-based diet is a source of a lot of stress and a lot of just agitation in their lives. It's actually ironically undermining their health and happiness when the whole idea is that we are trying to advise people to eat this way to improve their health and happiness. But at some point that can really turn into this source of diminishing returns for people because it is incompatible with their personality to the extent that very few people are capable of being perfect all the time. And when you hold yourself to that standard and consider yourself a failure if you don't meet up to it, you're really setting yourself up for a lot of feelings of failure and regret and guilt and just all the things that go along with that. So I wanted to talk about that and kind of, you know, just kind of have a message of you're okay if you're not perfect. You're okay if you slip up. It's really not the end of the world. And all you have to do is correct your course, get back on track, and just kind of get on with it rather than catastrophize, which is what so many people will do.
Yeah, I really liked this course correction. You showed a picture of a map. You showed that video of this waffle girl, which was hilarious. Tech malfunctioned in the middle of a statement about it. And then it's like people are hearing it in the background. I really want these waffles.
Yeah. Waffle girl. If people listening have not seen the meme, it's worth looking up. It's this poor little girl who's probably 4 or 5 years old who is just crying about how she can't stop dreaming about waffles and she doesn't understand why. And she's through her tears. She's just begging for waffles, but she's really more sort of confused about why she just can't stop thinking about them. She wants to stop thinking about them. And her mom says, you know, you just ate something else. And I don't know why you can't stop thinking about waffles, but you need to. And she's just beating this child is beating herself up for being obsessed with waffles. And of course, this is the story of most adult humans who struggle with the pleasure trap. It's really just kind of the same phenomenon. So the echo of the little girl kind of continued throughout the presentation. Mm-hmm.
Well, it was a lot of fun there. I think we got to see all the usual suspects in the NHA movement. So one in particular that we like to poke fun of here on the show, Dr. Alan Goldhammer. So that was fun to see him element in all ways. So
No, it was great. It was great information, and it's I think a really wonderful resource for especially the people who do have that personality, that kind of hyper conscientious. You know, we call this the hyper health arena of people who are really looking to do an excellent, excellent job with their diet and lifestyle. And there's no better place. For mere mortals, it's very good aspirational information. I just don't want it to become this kind of bar for people to hold themselves to and then, you know, just become a reason to hate themselves. That's not what we're in the business of trying to create. We don't want people to be miserable. So we want people to experience as much joy and happiness as possible in their life. And some of that comes from recognizing the limitations of your personality or of your conscientiousness. And, it's kind of just a different version of the standard line that Doug will give on this question, which is you want to do a B+ job. You don't necessarily want to do an A+ job if you're not an A+ student. You want to do a B+ job to do, miss most of the terrible consequences of the modern standard American diet, and maybe not optimize completely on all of the benefits that you would get from doing an excellent, perfect job, but to have pretty good results, certainly relative to most people in the population.
Mm-hmm. And I forgot who said this. I thought it was Chef AJ, but I don't want to misquote her. But I heard someone say something to the effect of, you can, you know, deviate as much as you can get away with on the diet.
Yeah. 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 I think one of the problems is that of course, is the correct answer, right? So many people ask this, do I have to be perfect? Is it okay to cheat once in a while? Like, you know, what can I get away with? And the hard answer that's really difficult to communicate to the masses is that is a completely individual process. It's really, really individual to everybody. And you have to know yourself. You have to know your personality. You have to know your tendencies. You have to know if you give yourself one cheat meal a week, is that going to stay one cheat meal a week, or is it going to turn into, you know, you wake up face down in a gutter of vegan ice cream and a month later and you don't really know what happened or what day it is. And that will happen to some people. And so you have to know your own limits. You have to know what the consequences of, you know, departing from your goals are, what that is going to look like and what it's going to mean for you. And people, the unfortunate truth is that you don't know what those answers are until you go through this some number of times. So if you haven't been through the process and you haven't made those mistakes and you haven't paid the costs of making those mistakes, you actually don't know what the cost is. And you probably don't really fully quite understand what the cost is even the second or third or fifth time that you make the mistake. It's this iterative process where you get to know exactly what you can get away with by not getting away with it for some amount of time. This is what they call in 12-step relapse as part of recovery. It's the heart of how I look at managing the pleasure trap in any guise, whether it's food or alcohol or anything else. It's, you don't know how costly departure from the goal line is until you do it enough times that you really understand, okay, I don't want to do that anymore. That costs too much. I was underestimating the cost, and I was underestimating the benefit of sticking to the plan. And once you recalibrate according to that actual information that can only come from making missteps, then organically, naturally, you're whole cost-benefit analysis changes and your motivation changes, and you're going to stay on the straight and narrow more consistently and just more easily than if you had tried to force it at the beginning before you had made those mistakes. So it's a little bit paradoxical in that way.
That's such a good point, Dr. Hawk, because, you know, if people are motivated, it feels like if people are motivated due to some disease process that will likely, you know, affect their life negatively enough so that they're motivated to change their diet and lifestyle. If they change their diet and lifestyle sufficiently, they'll get such good results that now this disease may go away all of a sudden, mm-hmm. now leading to their motivation to wane a little bit because now, mm-hmm. now it's not quite as pressing for them to continue doing so.
Mm-hmm. That happens all the time. People kind of get stuck, you know, they either regain some weight or they slip in their habits a little bit for all kinds of reasons, because they've resolved their big health issue or because they've lost enough weight that they kind of don't don't have that intrinsic motivation anymore like they did when they started off. You're always running that CB. And if the journey from here to there of the last 10 pounds is going to be a huge pain in the ass and take a lot of time and energy to pull off, but you're not going to get that much additional status by doing it more than you've already gotten. You know, very few people can get out of that motivational trap because the nervous system says, no, we're not going to waste all that time and energy. Why would we? The math doesn't check out here. We would rather invest in some other process that has a more guaranteed, more significant payoff, because that's only going to get you a few more points in the status bucket, and it's going to be a lot of trouble to get there. So that's almost never inherently motivating.
Mm-hmm. And also, thank you. That's such a great point. I mean, I look at, you know, a lot of the patients here at Fasting Escape and, you know, other patients I've worked with, it's, you know, and this disease process has been going on for so long, so they can kind of get in a version of this ego trap where it's not worth it anymore. They're already too far gone. And then it's just not something they want to deal with anymore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, there's all, that's one of the many forms it'll take. There's, you know, we saw at True North, you might see this too, where people kind of use it as a way to manage in a cyclical kind of way. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of, you know, they kind of let it rip the rest of the time. And then, you know, a couple times a year, they'll come back and do this really kind of, you know, it's often rooted in this very harsh energy toward themselves, this kind of punishment energy, like, oh, I've been bad. And so I need to atone for my sins, and I need to go back into the process and make up for all the bad things I've done. And that was the kind of thinking I was really trying to steer people away from in my NHA talk. It was like that you're not, you haven't committed a sin, you haven't done anything bad. There's nothing about your behavior around food says anything about your value as a human being or your worth as a human. It just means that you're a victim of the pleasure trap, as most people are to some degree or another. And so all of the narratives that people will take on in this kind of attempt to, you know, kind of, I don't know, maybe get some points with their internal audience or get some points externally in a form of status to sort of look at how much I hate myself for doing this. It's not actually doing anybody any good. And there is no moral or value judgment on your behavior here. You're just stuck in the trap, and all you have to do is haul yourself back out yet again. And it's not that big a deal at all. It's sort of mundane and boring, like, oh, yep, here we go, back on, and you're likely to fall off again tomorrow, and then you just get back on. And so the whole metaphor that I used in the talk was this course correction. If you're a pilot who is flying from Chicago to Seattle, and you notice at some point that the plane has drifted 2 degrees off course, what most people do in that scenario with their diet is they say, oh, well, screw it. You know, we're pointing the wrong direction. So let's just run out the tank and see where we land. And we'll start again from Saskatchewan or wherever we wind up, you know. And that's obviously, you don't want your pilot doing that. And that's not what a pilot is going to do. They're going to say, oh, looks like we're slightly off course and we need to make this slight adjustment and get back on course. And you have to do that hundreds of times throughout a trip. And so that's what we're doing. We're just kind of staying steady, looking, seeing where you're going, seeing how far off course you are, and adjusting as you go.
Wonderful. And just not letting some anxieties get to you, in the sense that to get you off course, like the anxieties about your health or your dating life or anything else that might be, feel like it's more pressing, you think?
Yeah, well, I think people, I think that's just part of life. So I think part of, you know, when people, we're kind of hard on the concept of emotional eating in a way that I think we're not always super clear about. Of course, people do emotionally eat when they are facing a lot of life stress. So if you're dealing with a lot of uncertainty, you've got relationship stress, work stress, you are going to go hunting around for the lowest hanging dopamine fruit that you can find. And if that happens to be in your environment, there happens to be really exciting, stimulating, high calorie dense food, you're going to go after that. You're just trying to make yourself feel better. Every single one of your ancestors would have done the same thing. They just wouldn't have had access to the same kind of food that you have. So it wouldn't have been as destructive. When we're going after emotional eating, we're really talking more about people imagining that they're self-soothing with pleasure trap food because it has some kind of childhood association. It's the, you know, these cookies that my grandma made, and therefore when I feel sad, I want those cookies. You want those cookies because they represent this super normal, high calorie density, you know, exciting little source of dopamine that it sits in your memory and it's associated with some good feelings. And so you're going to go for it. But there's nothing intrinsically, you know, there's nothing particular about those cookies that's hitting any particular type of circuit related to any particular kind of trauma that you may have had.
Dr. Hawk, I'm so glad that you mentioned vegan ice cream once, and then next one you said low-hanging dopamine fruit, because I think if you would have said it twice, I would have had to go get some after this show.
One of the lines from my talk was, vegan ice cream is not a crime.
Oh, here it is. You just said it. Dang it.
Yeah, I got some. There's a tough crowd to try to sell on that line. I could see daggers coming out of Goldhammer's eyes.
Oh, yeah. But they did have some black bean brownies. I know our listeners just think that sounds absolutely delicious, but they were pretty good.
I think I miss those. The carrot cake donuts were really good. Those were impressive. And there were some other good. Yeah, it was. We were fed well for sure.
Yeah, I love the NHA conference because it's one of the rare conferences where you can go and everything is pretty much safe and I don't have to ask around. Does this have that in there? Or just wonder or be socially appropriate and just eat the decorations, you know, around the garnishes.
Yeah. Well, it was also nice because it was a real conference. It was my first, I don't know about you, but it was my first experience, you know, in a year and a half of the old times.
Like, got to see all the faces and
Yeah. Well, not even that. I mean, even if I hadn't known anybody, it was great to see old friends and see you and see Goldhammer and everybody else. Dylan and Reeves were there. There were lots of great folks there. But it was just the feeling of being in a crowded conference hall, you know, and sort of shoulder to shoulder with people and being in that conference setting. It took me some time to adjust to it after living a COVID life for a year and a half. I guess I've been living in a very blue area wherever I've been living, and it's not been like that at all. So I was sort of taken aback at first. You know, people coming up to introduce themselves, I'm like, don't you want to stand back further? this is too close. This feels too close. But I adjusted to it very quickly, and it was a little bit like being a time traveler.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, speaking of these anxieties that people have, we have, what do you say we get to a couple of questions?
Sure. Let's see what we have. Yeah.
Perfect. Okay. So our first question is from, it looks like another Jimmy the guitar player. So Dr. Hawk, I chose this question because just for you.
Aren't they organized against me? Don't they have like an anti-Hawk union at this point? I feel like they
No, actually.
I've offended the Jimmies.
All right. Dear doctors, I am a fairly successful artist in his late 20s. My big five is highly distorted. 98th percentile openness, 75th percentile conscientiousness, 98th extroversion, 15% agreeableness, and 98th percentile neuroticism, which has gotten me into all sorts of trouble. But luckily, I have a high enough IQ that has kept me on the right track. Your podcast and website have helped in almost every arena, but I can't shake my Jimmy genes. I find myself falling in love, but losing interest just as quickly. This has caused many unhappy romantic relationships, sometimes even when I desperately want them to work. My question is, how can a Jimmy, who would love to pair bond, beat his genes? Is there a 10-page date rule for men? What is the right environment if I can't change my personality?
Oh, man. Maybe wait until your testosterone drops in your 70s.
Is that the reason to eat vegan ice cream, right? Just so you can drop quicker.
Right, right, exactly. Get on a standard American diet and, you know, sabotage your health. And so then, yeah, you'll be uninterested in romance by, you know, 45. You're cornered in a lot of directions, personality-wise and Jimmy the guitar player-wise. I mean, you're a young guy in your 20s who is self-described as fairly successful. I mean, you were supposed to be advertising and waiting around for the absolute highest quality mate you can possibly get. And you believe, especially with that level of openness, the openness alone, plus the extroversion would make whatever kind of inherent, pair bond tendency you had and other personality factors, it would make really like serious pair bond commitment difficult for anybody in that situation, just because there's this incredible fear of missing out. There's this incredible interest in new frontiers of all types. And so you're just really, really, really in a tough position. So, I mean, you've listened to the podcast enough, I'm sure, that there's nothing really I can say about how you can't force yourself to settle. You can't force yourself to be resigned to this kind of thing. You were just in a situation where you're on this side of the equation of the casual mating pair bond continuum, where you just need, you, instead of the magic 10%, you probably need something more than that. You really need your socks knocked off. And, you know, you will get to a point where there is somebody in principle who you could see as real Parabon material. I think a lot of that comes with just the experience of realizing that no potential pair bond is 1,000% perfect. They're always going to be trade-offs one direction or another. I talk to a lot of young guys in your situation who are struggling with the reality of trade-offs. Like, oh, well, this one's really intelligent, but she's not as sexually exciting as the last one. And this one is great with my elderly parents, but, you know, she doesn't want to have kids, et cetera, et cetera. There are always these trade-offs, these situations, you're just going to run into it. And kind of like what I was talking about before with relapse as part of recovery, I think part of the wisdom that comes with age and experience is reckoning with those trade-offs and realizing that you can hold out for absolute perfection for as long as you want. You're unlikely to find it, but you can get to a point where you've calibrated and you've calibrated and you've calibrated where you can recognize a major outlier when you find one. And that's unlikely to happen for anybody by their late 20s. It doesn't necessarily happen for everybody at all. I think it happens for a lot of people, but it comes with time and it comes with calibration. And for you, it might take longer than most, just because you need more data. This is. I think we've talked on the podcast about the princess equation. Have we talked about this?
Remind us.
This is attributed. It's attributed to so many people. I don't know who to give credit to it. I don't know where it originally came from. And of course, because it's attributed to so many people, it takes many forms. But the general idea is that in principle, there is a correct equation for determining, for finding your princess. If you've got a village full of women and you're trying to find your princess. Or if you were a prince, however the story works and whatever shape it takes, you essentially, there's some algorithm by which you go through that population. You date as much as you can until you're 30, or some of the equations are 35, and you assign each of those mates a value. And this is kind of where the whole thing falls apart, because, you know, unlike Doug, I don't put numbers on people. And this isn't just a beauty number. This is a general mate value number. And so, you know, you've dated 100 women by the time you're 30 years old, and they all are somewhere between 1 and 100 in terms of what kind of princess they would be for you. And so the one who is the highest number by the time you get to that arbitrary cutoff, whether it's 30 or 35 or whatever it is, or some number of women that you've been with, say it's 85. You've never gotten higher than 85 on your mate value spectrum. That's where you kind of set the marker. And so then the next princess you meet who is 85 or higher, that's the one you marry. Just because that's sort of at that point, mathematically, you've gathered enough points of data that you've recognized that the next one who's that high or higher is the outlier. You're not likely to run into somebody higher than that in a reasonable amount of time. So that's kind of the very kind of pointy headed, nerdy way of looking at this. But that's the general idea, that's what everybody is doing in the dating arena, whether they go about it in that sort of Virgo sort of way or not. they're playing the field, they're getting a sense of who's out there, and they're learning as they go about what they value the most and what kinds of trade-offs they can live with and what kinds they can't. And then at some point, ideally, we would hope before you're 70, you run into somebody who's sort of like, whoa, you know, I haven't found one like this before, or I only found one like this before and I was young and 22 and stupid and I let her go and I shouldn't have. And so here's another one, and I didn't think I'd get another chance, so I'm going to lock her down. That's just kind of how it works. And so you just stay open to that, and there's really nothing more in the meantime that you can do to force your nervous system into accepting an outcome that you're not on board with.
Mm-hmm. And to people that might who may ask, if Jimmy goes about and just, you know, fully expresses his Jimmy genes, will that hamper his chances for a pair bond, or is it kind of like whenever it comes out, he'll immediately change his ways essentially?
Hamper his chances in what way? Just that he would scare off serious pair bonders?
That's a good point. I didn't think of it like that. What I was thinking about was, yeah, will too many casual encounters prevent Jimmy from enjoying a pair bond encounter or a pair bond life, essentially?
Oh, well, possibly, but there's really no way that we can stop that process from happening. So we have to kind of start with the assumption that that process is happening rather than telling poor Jimmy to, you know, become a monk and mm-hmm. lock himself away from romantic attention, because that's not a reasonable way to tackle this. In principle, would Jimmy have been better off in a context with less availability and, you know, more competition and just sort of a whole different context? Maybe. Would he have been happier in the Stone Age where there were only four girls in the village? Maybe. But with openness that high and extroversion that high, he would have been setting sail for the next village anyway. This would have been the guy who would have been absolutely, you know, finding out what was over the next hill all the time. So I think no matter what approach you take, if you want to be, you know, you want to honor the personality that you have, you're checking out the goods. you are playing the field in a very serious way. And so, yeah, there is some danger. I mean, I think we've talked about this before, where, you know, a lot of people in the online dating environment, with the swipey apps in particular, it's this infinite supply. And so you never come to terms with the trade-offs, because you just keep pursuing perfection. You keep pursuing perfection. It's like, well,
and it's always being dangled in front of you too.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Well, and that's the, I think men have more of a more innate difficulty recognizing how significantly they're being bluffed early on, and sort of the degree of deception that women can display personality wise. I think women are more, I think they're sensitized to it beauty wise, like, oh, let's see how she looks, you know, the morning after, but. In my experience, men are not as sensitized to it personality-wise. So women are just as capable of being deceptive and bluffing their agreeableness, their conscientiousness, their extroversion, any personality quality that looks really attractive at the beginning for some amount of time. And so this perpetuates the cycle of, oh, the one I've got here is, she's 89% perfect, but the one that I'm talking to on this app seems like awesome. You know, she doesn't have all these flaws that this other one has, and she doesn't, you know, harass me about leaving my socks on the floor or not doing the dishes. That was like a total Doug-ism, you know, like. But she's not nagging me about the things that my current broad nags me about. And so, hey, I'm gonna move over to this seemingly more glittery option over here. And you're really, you know, you're very likely to be paying a real cost for the early deception that happens in any relationship. Not that she's doing it maliciously or even consciously, just because people are always trying to over-signal and over-display their mate value early in a relationship. And I think women are more attuned to that because they're seeking to rule out. They're just so attuned. They're just, that's their whole mission, is they're looking for reasons to rule you out. So if there's any inconsistency in your facade, they're going to pick up on it quicker. Whereas males are a little more optimistic in that regard, in my experience. So, but yeah, it's a terrible, terrible cycle where you just always think you can improve upon what you have, and maybe you can even improve upon it for some amount of time, but then that crashes and burns, and so you just repeat the cycle again and again and again, where really any meaningful pair bond is going to have trade-offs that sort of start to feel intolerable in an environment of infinite supply, and you're in a position to qualify for a lot of girls, and it's a really, really, really hard process to get around. So yeah, I would say just give it time and let life happen and hope for the best, as all of us do.
Well, you've given me pause to think. Perhaps we have to go to, you know, a Buddhist temple and live out the remainder of our days. Oh, or maybe not even Buddhist temple. Maybe the yurt community that you were talking about a couple shows ago.
Yeah, totally. Let's go hang out in our yurts and, you know, connect them with hamster tunnels when we want to socialize. And the rest of the time, sit in deep meditation, reflecting on the cruelty of reality and the human condition.
Okay, well, you want, why don't we do one more question? What do you think?
Sure. Yeah? Let's see what we got.
Okay. Dear doctors, I'm a young male adult in his 20s, and I truly enjoy studying, working out, training, and just overall being productive. I know it's because I'm trying to gain mate value and climb social structures, but I truly do enjoy it. I just generally can't understand how people can party or work their entire lives away at a fast food joint just to play video games when they get off work and slowly go more and more into sleep debt as the years pass them by. But I also realize that in the end, I'm no different, and my path in life will still see me at the grave nonetheless. But that's just how I see life and productivity. Now, I recently acquired a girlfriend, and I found that I'm more attracted to bouts of what...
Like a company? Okay, proceed.
Yeah, I've acquired a girlfriend, and I found that I'm more attracted to bouts of watching YouTube videos for a few hours at night before I go to bed, or just generally being less productive. I've had problems here and there, but most of the time I avoid the temptation altogether, and it works well. But the energy to stop relaxing and start working once I'm there is more than I'm willing to muster, it seems. It may be that this is just how I feel right now in life, and in a month or two I'll be more productive again. But do you think it's possible that now that I have a mate, my brain doesn't believe I have as serious as a need to climb structures and gain skills? If so, that is seriously depressing. Looking forward to your thoughts.
Oh, man. I don't just think it's possible. I think that's absolutely what's going on. I mean, this is the whole reason that you're doing all of these things is to get what you have. And so... it is seriously depressing. I mean, going back to the earlier question, you're likely to feel your motivation start to dial up when you start to see some flaws in this human that you haven't seen yet. And so even if you're not necessarily interested in leaving the relationship or finding another relationship, you want to be ready in case that opportunity were to present itself out of the blue. And so you want your internal audience to be observing that you're improving your mate value all the time. So if she no longer qualifies for you at the level that she qualifies now, which is likely in any medium or long-term relationship, there's sort of, you know, there's going to be that early bluff is going to wear off a little bit, and you're going to come face to face with some things that maybe you don't love as much as you thought you did. Or conversely, if you realize that you really have gotten somebody who's incredible and you can't believe that you're with her, then you're still going to feel motivated to improve yourself, to continue to impress her and to keep her. So if she starts showing defection signals, that's interesting. She could show defective or defection signals. Either way,
well, what's the opposite of acquiring a girlfriend? You. He'll try to start it off.
Exactly. Some sort of corporate merger. I think you just have to sit back and watch your nervous system here. It's very, very likely that whatever you're experiencing now is just this complacency that is coming with the calibration to this new situation. And you kind of don't know what sort of deal it is and how you feel about it. And so the whole system says, let's just kind of hold off and not invest any more time and energy in any kind of process until we know where we stand, and what we're actually in the business of doing, and what sort of display we need to the world to get us to where we want to be. So you kind of don't know what that is yet, because it's a recent acquisition. So I would just enjoy the break if possible, and just let yourself have that experience. And it's very, just personality wise, it sounds like you're quite a go-getter and you have a lot of innate initiative and a lot of drive, and that's not going to disappear. It's not just going to abandon you because you got what you want. The nature of that sort of initiative and drive is that it's never quite satisfied. It's got this real restlessness to it. So I suspect that will come back with a vengeance pretty soon.
Wow, Dr. Hawk, thank you so much. Really appreciate these answers and the discussion. It's you bring a way of analyzing these questions that that a lot of our listeners really appreciate, including the Jimmies. So don't get too down on yourself.
I have a soft spot for the Jimmies. I just can be a little hard. It's just, you know, tough love. I'm trying to help them. Help me help you.
All right. Well, Dr. Hawk, thank you so, so much for coming on this evening. And we will look forward to our next show with you and Dr. Lyle coming up in the next couple weeks. And for our listeners, again, if you want to check out, there's a couple of ways you can get in touch with Dr. Lyle or Dr. Hawk. One of them is esteemdynamics.com. You can go to the website. They're also joining the Living Wisdom Library. You can become a member there and also get dibs on their new book coming out soon. And we've got the Dr. Hawks. You've got your Hawk Blocked, which is the Patreon. Patreon website. And then you got the Virtual Village. Is that right?
Yeah, that's part of the Patreon system. So yeah, if you join for $15 a month, you get access to the weekly live stream, where we talk about all kinds of things. There's no telling what we cover every week. Sometimes it's quite scandalous. Too hot for YouTube.
But not necessarily too hot for Gab, which is where people can find you as well.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. That's why I'm retreating to the dark, dark corners of the internet.
Well, may the force be with you, and we will look forward to chatting with both you and Dr. Lyle coming up soon.
Sounds good, Nate. Great to talk to you. Have a good one.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.